This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. One of the problems with the way state government is run is that a very small number of lawmakers seem to get all the press. The leadership in both houses and in both parties make most of the news, they grab most of the headlines, and are most responsible for how things get done, it seems. But the rank-and-file members we send to the Capitol have big ideas of their own, and today we want to talk about some of the big issues that they're grappling with. You can join us. What do you want to see our state lawmakers get done during this legislative session? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherelive. Joining us in studio today to grapple with some of the things that are happening up at the Capitol is Senator Gary Holder Winfield, who represents the 10th State Senate District of New Haven and West Haven. First time we've spoken with you since you've become a brand new senator. Gary Holder Winfield, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I also want to welcome back Representative Gail Abiel, who serves the 143rd General Assembly District, which represents Norwalk, Westport, and Wilton. Good to have you back on the show, Representative. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you, John.
And Representative Matt Lesser, who serves the 100th General Assembly District. It's Middletown, Middlefield, Durham, and Rockville? Rockfall?
Rockfall, but actually—
What is Rockfall? Rockfall. I've never heard of Rockfall.
It exists. I promise you it's part of Middlefield. Actually, I only represent Middletown now. Since redistricting, I lost Rockfall and those other towns.
You lost Rockfall. That must have been a blow.
It was. I'm still getting over it.
Hopefully somebody will call in from Rockfall today, because I know the state pretty well, Matt, and I will say I don't know very much about Rockfall.
Don't knock a door in Middlefield and say you're in Rockfall or vice versa. They'll never let you forget
They'll never let you forget it. These are things we just didn't know. We hope to hear from somebody from the Senate Republicans as well today. We've asked a number of members, and hopefully we'll be able to get somebody here as well. Again, you can join us 860-275-7266. Before we get to some of the specifics, and I had asked each and every one of you to bring maybe a few issues that we're going to talk about. I know there's some education issues, some business issues. We're going to be talking about fracking waste a little bit. I'll start with you, Gary, and just get a sense of how things are going at the Capitol this year. It's an election year, of course, which means people are concerned about getting reelected. It's a year in which we're not grappling with the state budget in quite the same way we normally do. What's the tone there at the state capitol in terms of what you feel like you can get done and not?
I think that depends on who you ask at this point. I think many of us during an election year tend to feel like it goes a little bit slower than the other year. But we do deal with the budget, and we deal with significant changes to the budget. So I think a lot of focus in this year is the same as in the other year, which is the budget and what impact it will have on the people in Connecticut when we make the tweaks that we make to it. There are other issues that have come up, and some of them have already gone away. We've had Aiden dying, I think it was discussed on WNPR at one point. I'm particularly concerned about a bill I did last year, which is a bill about school drug zones. I know you've talked about that. And all of the myriad of issues that we talk about throughout the years tend to come back up. This year, particularly, I have a focus that's on the Judiciary Committee, even though I'm now the chair of Labor. Many of the bills that came up last year that I thought were good bills are back there. Labor is dealing with some really important issues. We did the minimum wage bill, raising the minimum wage in a couple of years to over $10. There are a lot of issues that are at play. And really, the question is, do we get them done in the next 2.5 weeks? And I think you have to stay tuned.
Well, I know. And one of the things I put in my introduction is we'll have to stay tuned. We'll probably have to stay tuned until the very last minute of the end of the session. And then hopefully we'll know what's in those bills. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. Later on. Gail, how about you from the Republican side? It's a little harder to get traction with some of the legislative initiatives that you have, but at the same time, you have this opportunity to move things. What are the big things on your radar right now?
Well, Gary's right. It depends on who you ask in terms of what you can get done. But, of course, the biggest preoccupation is in the even-numbered years like this one, we have to do the midterm budget adjustments. And because it's an election year, the folks on my side of the aisle, we feel that there has been a little bit too much playing with the budget to make it look like there's more revenue, more surplus than there actually is. The same way if you got to the end of the year and yourself and didn't have any money and you stuck your credit card in an ATM and got some money out, you'd have a surplus. So we're concerned with making the budget look the way it is, not the way that someone wants it to be.
How do you fix that? That's been a problem we've talked about for years and years and years, and it predates, obviously, this administration. Budget tricks and gimmicks are something that Republican governors have done and Democratic governors have done. As you sit there as a state lawmaker and you're tasked with writing laws and trying to figure out ways to spend or not spend this money, what can you really do about this?
Well, see, it doesn't matter to me who did it before. I don't think we should do it now. And we did, the House and Senate Republicans did put forward an alternative way of presenting and structuring the midterm budget adjustments last week. And we eliminated all of the putting off debt payments, raiding funds, borrowing, things like that. We reversed all the maneuvers to show what the budget would really look like. And then we showed what we would spend money on and what we wouldn't. And some of the Democratic ideas were good, like restore the elderly rental rebate program, things like that, or spending on mental health. But other things we just can't afford. So we actually showed what it would look like so that taxpayers would have an honest view, at least, of what their money's being spent on.
Matt Lesser, before we get to some of the legislative agenda items that are on your plate, I know that this is one of the big battles there. Quite often, Republicans will say, we're spending more money than we actually have. Democrats say, well, look, we have a surplus, and there's a lot of things that we need to get done at the state level as well. Do you think that we have the money to do all of the things that we suggest we're going to try to do every legislative session?
Well, we could always use more money, but our nonpartisan Office of Fiscal Analysis agrees on how much money we have with the Office of Policy and Management. We have a new nonpartisan way of figuring that out, so we don't get into this bickering back and forth. And everybody agrees we have a surplus. What's fun is to hear our Republican friends say, yes, we have no surplus at all, despite what our analysts say, or a very small one, but we should be giving out tax cuts to spend it and return it back to the wealthiest in the state. Something doesn't quite add up. And I understand it's an election year, every other year is an election year for those of us in the House and the Senate. And so it's important for us to not get bogged down in what I think is oftentimes some posturing and focus really on the nuts and bolts of getting stuff done for our constituents.
When you say we could always use more money, I think a lot of people in the state might say, well, yeah, I mean, what are you going to do with that money? It's not just money out of nowhere that you're making. It's money that comes from taxpayers. So make the case that more money coming to state government is actually going to be good for the people of Connecticut.
Sure. Well, for example, Governor Malloy and leaders in both houses have really identified early childhood education as one of the key issues that we should be investing in. We have also identified key industry clusters that we're trying to grow in the state, like biotechnology, these fast-growing sectors that we're trying to take advantage of so that other states, other countries aren't leapfrogging ahead of us. And so there are critical investments there and infrastructure that we need to be making. I'm not suggesting that we raise taxes. We have a surplus right now. But we do have real needs that we need to be spending money on, including early childhood. And it would be great to be investing there.
In just a moment, we're actually going to get to early childhood. But this idea that we have a surplus now, Gary, it's something that we talk with the governor about. We talk with his budget folks about. Look, all indications are that in the next few years, we're talking about a big budget deficit, not a budget surplus, maybe a budget deficit of $1 billion. There's a bit of reality in the numbers behind that. How do we grapple with this idea that we're saying we have a surplus, but in actuality, our books aren't balanced in the next couple of years?
I think this is a discussion I've heard you talk to the governor about, and it's a discussion that I think a lot of people are concerned about. The Republicans raised their issues on it. I think both things are true. I think it's true that we have a surplus and that we have the issue going forward. I think part of the issue is that long-term thinking, whatever administration you have, is not the way that we do the budget process. The budget process is pretty much a point-in-time process. And so if you want to have a discussion about whether or not we should have the process be a different process, that's one thing. But to suggest that what is being done in the General Assembly is simply budget tricks, I think, is not accurate. I think if you have this process in place, and this process has been in place for a very long time, What some people would suggest a budget trick is actually the process for getting a budget done. And it may not be the process that people like, but it's the way that the budget gets done. And we all have a part to play in this. The committees that we have are not partisan committees. They're not committees of Democrats solely. They're committees where people on both sides of the aisle get to participate in this process. And I think that's important to remember as we go forward.
Gail, you want a quick response before we move on to the next thing?
Well, it's not true that people on both sides of the aisle always get to participate, unfortunately. And we continue to offer. We're not always – the minority is not always invited into the room. But that said, the real problem here is not whether there is or is not a surplus at this very moment, at this snapshot in time. The question is whether it's a structural surplus. In other words, a structural surplus is when your ongoing revenues continue to be more than your ongoing expenses,
But I think Gary's point is that the way budgets get done, and again, this isn't something that got put together by any of the three of you or, frankly, anybody who's mm-hmm. serving at the state capitol right now. It's a system that is a point in time, and so we make budgets the way we make them. What you're suggesting is that we have to, in a wholesale way, restructure the way we write budgets at the state level? Because if we don't do that, I mean, this will never change. We're always going to make two-year budgets that are always kind of out of balance in the out years.
Well, that's true. And it's also a problem for businesses, because when we're doing these two-year budgets on a two-year horizon and no thought for the future, businesses have to plan on a 5 or 10 year time frame. And they have no predictability. And I think that's one reason that our business climate has deteriorated as much as it has. So I agree. We do need to look at the process.
And we're going to talk about a bit more about the business climate coming up. I know it's one of the things that Representative Gail LaBelle wants to talk about. We're also joined by Senator Gary Holder Winfield, Representative Matt Lesser. We've also reached out to the Senate Republicans as well. Hopefully we have somebody either calling in or coming in here during our program as well. The cameras of CTN are here, and we'd like to ask you to call us at 860-275-7266. If you have questions for your state lawmakers, how you think they're doing, what you think they need to do during this short legislative session, you can also email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. Now, here's State Senate President Don Williams speaking during the announcement of Connecticut's Smart Start at the state capitol earlier this month.
An investment in high-quality early childhood education pays the biggest dividends of all in education. I'm talking about working through the traditional public schools, the schools that educate over 90% of the students in Connecticut. I'm talking about pre-K being delivered by certified teachers, by programs that are accredited, with a classroom size of no more than 16 students. But we're talking about nothing less than basic fairness in education. We're talking about equal opportunity in education.
So that's State Senate President Don Williams. Gary Holder Winfield, tell us a bit more about what the plan is for at least getting toward universal pre-K in the state.
This is a plan that came up about a week and a half ago at this point. What the Senate Democrats want to do is take $200 million over 10 years, put it towards that effort. We've been talking about early childhood education, both in terms of pre-K, getting towards a universal pre-K, and in terms of what we do in those early grade years. I, in particular, along with some of the members of the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, have had some proposals circulating around the Capitol for a couple of years on what we do in early reading. And so there's been a lot of discussion about this. There's been the creation of an Office of Early Childhood that's still being made more of a reality. And the Senate Democrats have come up with an idea for a way of looking at this issue and funding it. And that's part of the discussion at this point. And part of the discussion, to be honest, is how that funding comes about and whether that's the right thing to do and whether we've talked about this enough, as with almost any issue that has some level of controversy to it.
Well, talk a bit about the funding model. How does this get paid for? Obviously, making sure that the money flows to our schools has been one of the ongoing issues at the Capitol for a number of years. Is there fair funding for all of the school districts? Are the districts that are in most need getting what they need? Are we spending money that's not actually having any sort of results? So make the case for this investment, especially in the early years and in pre-K right now.
Well, I don't. In terms of making the case for investing in early childhood education, I think almost anyone you talk to at the Capitol will tell you at this point, after particularly the last 4 years, and information that has come to the General Assembly about early childhood education and what dividends it pays off in terms of the arc of education for our young people, that is something we want to do. Again, the question is whether or not you look to the monies coming from certain funds that we had allocated for a different purpose, or do you try to find out how do we get what some people would call a sustainable source separate from that? And those are the questions. The question is not really whether, at least in the minds of those, I believe, in the legislature, it's not really whether or not we should be doing it. It's how do we do it? And so I believe that's where, if you see any disagreement with what was proposed, the disagreement will be resident.
You want to add to that, Matt?
Yeah, I think that Senator Holden-Winfield hit it on the head. It's a question of how we get there. And I think we've all identified, all of the experts say, that the smartest single investment that we can make in our future economy is in early childhood education, because that's where brain development occurs. It's so much of what happens in a child's future academic career and in their life is dependent on what happens in their first 2 years. And so that's why it's critical to teach reading early, why it's so critical to provide early childhood instruction. And so right now the question isn't whether we should get there. It's a question of how we can get there. And when I said we need more money, this is exactly what the most – probably one of the most important priorities we can identify in the state.
Galaviel, when we talk about raising revenues for something like pre-K education, for getting a better early learning experience to tens of thousands of Connecticut children, how do we get there? How do we do that?
Well, this is, again, the early childhood education is the most important place to concentrate resources. If you can't read by the time you get out of third grade, it's very difficult to imagine how you can absorb the rest of your education. So this is critical. The problem is that we also need to know that when the money is devoted to this, that it is spent wisely and well, and we know what's happening. And I'm on the education committee and have supported all of these initiatives. I think it's critical to Connecticut's development and competitivity. But if we're not as well informed as we can be about how every single town and city is actually using these resources and that we're getting somewhere, then, you know, we may have some questions.
So give me an example of how that would work, of how we'd know better how the money's getting spent.
Well, so far, we've had two big education reform exercises since I've been in the legislature. And we decided to do a lot of things, but I still haven't had what I would call comprehensive reports about how much better some of the poorer poorer in terms of quality, school districts are doing, how well students are performing. And, of course, there's a lot of controversy over that. Is testing the way to do it? Is individual evaluation of each student the way to do it? Those are hard questions. And the idea even of how you assess reading ability has been kind of up for grabs. But there was a very good bill that the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus put in a couple of years ago that I was very strong supporter of, and I was sorry it was a little watered down by the time it got out, because there were some good suggestions in there about how to measure and promote and encourage literacy.
How can we do a better job with this, Gary?
Well, I was a big proponent of the bill, so I think we should do more of what the bill intended.
But tell us more about what's in the bill.
The bill was called the K through 3 reading bill. It did a couple of things. It provided the professional development for teachers who teach reading to help them better understand how to do their job. We know that a couple of years ago we discovered that teachers coming out of our schools didn't know all that they needed to do to be able to do their job. And that's not to blame the teachers. That's certainly to blame those who are educating the teachers for not giving them all of the resources they needed. So we went back and said, since they don't have those resources, let's make sure they're in place. Let's take those who are in the field, not punish them for not knowing, but make sure we give them what they need. Let's also make sure that when they are assessing our students, they have instruments that actually are useful to them. So there's an argument about whether the diagnostic reading assessment is a proper tool. We changed the law so that you could use other tools that may be more efficient. And there's a whole host of things that we've done. We've been able to, in the last couple of years, run some tests in the field in schools, and we've got gotten a lot of good information back. We've done several forums at the state legislature. We're working with UConn, and we're assessing the program. We're providing the data so that at some point in the near future, we can come back and say, we're not just asking you to put money towards a program we suspect will do good. We're running a we've run this program for a number of years in Connecticut. We're not using other states' data, and this is something we necessarily must put our money towards. So
we're going to be coming back to more education issues later. As a matter of fact, even hearing from some high school students who learn in this very building, asking a question about trying to keep kids in school. But before we quickly take a break, this issue of the education reforms that we have put in place, it's been very controversial, especially over the course of the last year. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not the teacher assessments that we put forward need to be slowed down or rolled back. And there have been the brakes put on some of these evaluations within the last few months. Whether or not rolling out a Common Core state standard that is putting Connecticut in alignment, at least, with learning that's going on all over the country is a good idea at this point. As we have a bipartisan talk here, Gary, one of the things that's interesting is I hear from people on the left that this whole Common Core is a really terrible idea. And I hear from people on the right who say this whole Common Core is a really terrible idea. And I'm trying to figure out who likes the reform that we actually put in place? I mean,
you give me that question.
I'm going to give you that question. I'm going to ask everyone that, but I'll give you that question first. I know you the best, so I'll ask. I think you.
I'm a lucky guy. I think what you have is not just an issue of Common Core, although it's spoken about as an issue of Common Core. I think what you have are a lot of things that hit at the same time. You have the education reform bill that we did in this state in 2012, which, by the way, to speak to a little bit very quickly about what Representative LaVielle was saying, I'm not sure at this point, almost two years from the passage of that bill, that you would be able to have the information to tell you where you are. You need a longer period of time to figure out how to assess the program. But you have that. You have Common Core. You had Race to the Top. You have all of these things that have hit the individuals who work in the education system at the same time. And so they all become one conversation. The basic notion of Common Core is a notion I think many people would agree with, that we should have a common set of standards, that we should know where our kids are. But I think, again, what you see is you see this regime of testing, both for the teachers and for students, that I think feels oppressive. And then on top of that, you have Common Core. And it's a mix for disaster. I think what we need in the time when we've pulled back is to have some conversations with those involved and to talk about where the different parts are and to figure out what we need to be doing and what we don't need to be doing.
Matt Lesser, quickly on this?
Yeah, well, I would say, again, what I would say is, one, it's the new standards, but it's two, new testing methods and also performance evaluations of teachers that are all hitting at the same time. And I think that often those issues get confused, even by people within the field. And I think it's not that any one of them is the problem. It's that they're all hitting at the same time. I think that's caused a lot of, at least in the districts that I've been working with, some chaos. And I think that's where I get the frustration.
You know, John, this shouldn't be a political issue, and normally it's not. But as Senator Holder Winfield said a minute ago, one of the problems was that we hadn't had conversation with all of the people affected by the introduction of all these elements at the same time. And so some folks in my caucus, I was one of them, called for hearings in the Education Committee on the implementation of the Common Core and the teacher evaluations. The chairs of education did not want to do that, but we used a signature petition device to get it done, and we did, and we heard from, I think, 127 people. The implementation of an assessment tool on a set of standards that no one had really used before to assess kids and then evaluate teachers on those assessments has been very difficult. So there certainly is call for slowing it down, but there's also a call for a much closer look at it than we've done so far.
Some people want to join our conversation as we talk about education. We'll stick with that for a moment. I know school drug zones is something Gary Holder Winfield wants to talk about. We're going to be talking about fracking waste. We're going to be talking about being business friendly. When we come back from our break, we're going to take some of your phone calls for state lawmakers at 860-275-7266. And we're going to hear from some very smart high school students right here in Hartford who are asking questions about keeping kids in school and what lawmakers can do to help that. It's all coming up right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking with state lawmakers today about some of the things happening at the Capitol, not just talking about budgetary issues, but a lot of issues having to do with education and some of the legislation that they've been working on. We're talking with Senator Gary Holder Winfield, Representative Gail LaViolle, and Representative Matt Lesser. We're taking your calls as well at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Hartford. Hello, Steve. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah.
I'm with a group in West Hartford called West Hartford Education Voters. And we met with Representative Andy Fleischman about 2 weeks ago to talk about the education reforms currently colliding, really, in our community in West Hartford. West Hartford's a town where schools are very, very important to the whole culture and sense of identity for our town. Our concerns were several, but we made two asks of Representative Fleischman. One was to decouple teacher evaluation from results from standardized tests until such a time as there was good research to suggest that teaching improved when teachers' performance was related directly to how children did on the standardized tests, which nobody has seen, and no one really knows how that's being implemented. The second ask was for there to be a task force, like the Common Core Task Force, to study the implementation of this new testing regime that I think will have far more consequence for education in Connecticut than the Common Core does. So my question of the panelists are, what are your positions on those two issues, and would you support a moratorium on teacher evaluation being tied to standardized test scores until such a time as we know it actually works? Representative Fleischman has been extremely helpful and supportive, and we're very encouraged by what he's going to try and do with these two topics.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for the question. So who wants to jump in and answer Steve's questions?
Well, I would say that in terms of a moratorium, absolutely. And, in fact, we've asked for moratoria.
I think it's
in a number of areas, because so much of this, sometimes you had a pilot that was put in place and you were already supposed to be getting results before it was over with. Mm-hmm. And that shouldn't be. You need to know what you're doing. Also, one size fits all models for all school districts don't always work. You have to maybe use different things for different places. And I don't think the folks in charge know enough about that yet. In terms of a task force, I don't know whether that's the best way to deal with.
We do tend to have a lot of task force here in the state.
And they don't always finish, and their results aren't always used. And my argument would be that the State Department of Education ought to be doing that anyway. That's something useful they could do as opposed to some of the other things that they do. So I agree with Steve in terms of something needing to be done. But I don't know whether a task force is necessarily the proper structure.
Matt, a thought on Steve's questions?
I think they're both excellent questions. To the first point, I think the stakeholders are in the process of negotiating a revised approach to the performance evaluations that, if it hasn't been announced, I don't think it has been, will be announced very shortly. And I think that will reflect a lot of his concerns. And like I said, I think the biggest problem is that all of these issues hit at once and are just overwhelming teachers and local school districts. And that's that seems to be the biggest single issue. But
I'll just ask quickly, Gary, before we move on from this. We've said a few times that all these issues hit at once. I mean, they didn't just magically all hit at once like a tsunami coming out of the blue here. We made this happen as a state. These issues happened because we, in part, were complicit in making them all come together at this time.
Well, that's absolutely true. Common Core, more or less so. But the other things we're talking about, yes, we had a large part to do with it. I think part of the reason for that, though, is that Connecticut found itself at a place where it was one of the worst in the nation in terms of its achievement gap. And I think that lit a fire under the legislature to do something. And people came at that from different directions. And many of them came with strong opinions and were – very adamant about pushing through the part that they thought was important to this. And so you have a whole bunch of things that come together. And unfortunately, this is the result of it. I just want to say very quickly, I think Matt Lesser was correct about allowing the process to play out where we're going to get a new look at the performance and evaluation. But I also think the part about a task force and whether or not task forces tend to work is something to really think about. I think task forces can be particularly useful to the work that we do at the General Assembly if they're constructed in a way that we want them to work and we want them to come back with results and we stay involved in that process. We don't just create them, but we as legislators stay involved in the process.
Yeah, I think I think they can be, and I've seen them be very useful over the years. And I think one of the problems is task forces have gotten a bad name in the legislative process because we have so many of them, mm-hmm. and so many of them seem ineffective or without any outcome at the very end. Let's go to one more quick phone call. And this Ed's in Middletown. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Good morning, John. Good morning, legislators.
Hi.
I'd like to ask a question about, I guess it's early childhood education, the funding part of it. I'm on the Board of Ed in Middletown, and I know the thing that hamstrings us the most is the lack of funding for state mandates that come down to us, and that includes Common Core. It is not fully funded. The cities end up having to pay for this, and while early childhood education is a magnificent goal, if it ends up being paid for by local taxpayers, it's a failure before it starts.
Ed, thank you very much for that. Matt, I think this is one of your constituents. I might throw this to you.
Well, I know Ed very well. Good to hear from you, Ed. That's Ed McKeon in Middletown. I want to say that, I agree. We've been focusing on figuring out how to pay for this on the state level rather than passing more mandates down to municipalities. And specifically, one of the issues that we're wrestling with in Middletown is what Gary Holder-Winfield just mentioned, which is closing the achievement gap and ensuring that the Alliance District grants that we got for some of our low-performing districts to close that gap are actually being used for what they were intended to and not being redirected for other municipal purposes. So it's that's been a priority of mine this session. I've been working with local and state leaders on that issue as well.
We've been talking about the education gap a little bit. One thing that we know about this is that black students are about twice as likely as white students to be chronically absent from school. Chronic absenteeism rates are higher in the urban districts, higher for students who are eligible for free lunch. Now, Connecticut lawmakers have been considering a bill to help children who are chronically absent to intervene before it affects their grades or they drop out. Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy students Nadia Gale and Kieran Johnson spoke to Catherine Meyer, who helped to write this new legislation. She's an attorney at the Center for Children's Advocacy. Let's listen.
What is the new legislation regarding chronic absenteeism at schools? And what does research tell us about students who are chronically absent?
The new legislation is basically requiring schools to look at attendance in a different way than they used to. Right now, schools do keep track of students who are truant, but in terms of attendance, all they did was they had what's called the average daily attendance, and there was one day during the year, I think it's usually October 1st, where they would actually count all the students who were present on that day and use that as kind of an average of who was present each day. The problem with that is that it doesn't take into account, kind of the revolving door of kids who might be present or absent or the kids who might be absent repeatedly. So what we wanted to do is kind of get Connecticut in line with national best practices that looks at attendance in terms of chronic absenteeism, which means that a student is absent for any reason, excused or unexcused, any reason, for more than 10% of the school year. The legislation first requires schools to keep that data and report it to the State Department of Education, and then for schools that have a certain percentage of chronically absent students, it requires them to take a certain intervention and institute what we're calling student attendance review teams, SARTs, which is basically just getting a group together of support staff and administrators and teachers, hopefully once a week or once every 2 weeks, and looking at the list of students who are chronically absent and then determining what interventions have been put in place for those students.
What are the strategies that are being used to prevent chronic absenteeism?
You know, I think absenteeism is a really tricky thing because you really have to get at the reasons behind why a student isn't coming to school, and there's so many different reasons, as you can imagine. The main thing that research shows that helps alleviate chronic absenteeism is having students connected to someone in the school community, somebody personally that they're connected with, that they get to know, that they know cares about them, that they know cares if they're going to be in school that day or not. So this can be, you know, it can be as formal or as informal. For example, in New York, they have what's called a success mentoring program, and they have a whole group of volunteers who are trained to see these check-in people. And so the student knows, you know, this is my person. He's going to be waiting for me when I come in to school that day. And just that simple fact, which seems very basic and is very low cost, in this case it's, you know, a total volunteer program, makes kids feel like they want to be there and makes them feel like somebody cares if they're there.
How does absenteeism affect dropout rates?
So, you know, as you can imagine, if a kid is chronically absent, they are far more likely to drop out. They're actually more likely to be involved in the juvenile justice system as well. Because, you know, if you're not there and you're disengaged, then, you know, as time goes on, you're less and less likely to re-engage. So that's why it's really important for us to work with kids as quickly as possible when they start becoming disengaged or start becoming absent, because we know that it's a pretty short timeline that we'd want to reach them before they're going to feel even more discouraged and even more, you know, outside of the school community. We want to make sure we can get them back in the school community.
That was Catherine Meyer. She's an attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. Helped to write legislation aimed at chronic absenteeism. She spoke with Karan Johnson and Nadia Gale, who are students at Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy. This interview is an excerpt from their podcast, Blue Mike Radio. You can find more at Blue Mike, and that's M-I-C, bluemikeradio.tumblr.com. A couple of great high school students concerned about this issue, clearly trying to take my job in the future with their great questions. Gary Holder Winfield, what do we know about this legislation? I mean, is this something that you think the legislature might want to bite off? The students are interested in this.
I'm interested in it as well. Before I transitioned to the Senate, I was on the Education Committee and actually put in a request to deal with this concept. Did not know I wouldn't be on the Education Committee. But let me say this. It's particularly important that we deal with chronic absenteeism. I think the effort to look at the 10% is a good effort. I think we can go beyond that, actually. I think we have learned, those who have done some research on chronic absenteeism, that long before you get to that 10%, we have patterns that develop that we can tell. So if a student is absent 2 or 3 days in a month on a repeated basis, we already know that student is likely to hit that 10%. So there are different ways, even beyond what is suggested in that interview, that we can look at so that we can do some intervention. We also know that in some places, chronic absenteeism is a symptom of what's going on in the community, in the home. Some of the things that we could do are, when we see earlier than when we hit the 10%, we could do some intervention to find out how we can help these students. One of the things I thought was particularly interesting was the individuals who would be in the school who would be mentors or something akin to that. One of the things that would be very useful is not only if we had them, but if students had agency in choosing those people, it creates a different type of relationship. So I think it's an important bill. I think it's something the legislature needs to put a lot of effort towards making sure we get right.
And Gail, you are on the Education Committee. What do you think?
Well, I supported the concept coming out of the committee, and it's very important. This is a big issue in a lot of school districts. In some school districts, it's not. And so where we need to be careful is some of those requirements. There has to be a weekly meeting. There has to be a report and all this sort of thing. There are some school districts where that's appropriate and others where it isn't, because we have to be attentive to what teachers tell me time and again about all of these mandates. When am I going to have time actually to teach? That's what they say. And so, again, it's one-size-fits-all approach. But for the school districts where this is an issue, I think it's absolutely critical, and I think our intervention's a good thing.
We're talking with Republican Representative Gail LaViolette and Democratic Senator Gary Holder Winfield, also Democratic Representative Matt Lesser. They're joining us in a bit of a legislative roundtable. We've been tackling a lot of education issues. We're going to be talking about fracking waste when we come back. We'll talk about some more things that are on your mind at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be kicking off our Made in Connecticut series with a conversation about bringing jobs back to Connecticut. Can our state be home to a boom of reshored jobs? how can we keep the skilled manufacturing jobs we do have? We'll listen back to a live conversation we held last week for our Made in Connecticut panel featuring Senator Chris Murphy and others. I hope you can join us tomorrow. Today, a legislative roundtable. We're talking about a variety of issues of things happening at the state capitol. Let's go to Jennifer in Glastonbury. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. It's John, but whatever. Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm concerned about Connecticut importing fracking waste from other states. I've been following the issue fairly closely. I'm a local coordinator with Food and Water Watch, and I appreciate Representative Lesser and Holder for co-sponsoring a bill on banning, but I don't want to see that language compromised as we move forward in the session. I think fracking waste is highly toxic. It can bioaccumulate with radioactivity in our shellfish if it gets spilled into our streams and eventually makes it down into the Long Island Sound. The potential for destroying industries and the health for Connecticut residents is just disastrous. And I'd really like to see our lawmakers either stay strong on a ban or enact a very lengthy moratorium until more research can be brought forth by scientists.
Well, let me put this to Matt Lesser. I know you've been working very hard on this issue. So tell us about the problem as we perceive it going in, because I think one of the things we want to make sure we understand is this a real issue in Connecticut before we start going ahead and banning fracking waste?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. And when I first introduced this legislation last year with Representative Jonathan Steinberg from Westport, the question we got from everybody was, is this really an issue? That was the conversation last year. This year, after doing research, the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection has done an enormous amount of research. Now the question isn't whether this is a problem, but what do we do about it? And that's now where we are, and I think that's what the caller was talking about. I think it's important for your listeners to know, if they don't, what fracking is. And it's drilling wells for generating natural gas, pumping huge amounts of water and chemicals into the rock to shatter the rock. And what comes back up, though, the water that comes back up is contaminated both with the chemicals but also with toxic salts and is often radioactive. And this is a huge question of what to do with all of this waste. Now, there are certainly advantages. There's we're getting lower cost gas. It's helping lower our energy prices as a result. But the problem is that the states that are doing this fracking, places like Pennsylvania and possibly soon to be as close as New York, are trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to say, we want the benefits of this low-cost, low energy source, but we want to export the consequences to other places, make them deal with it.
I'm just going to challenge you on that quickly. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they want to have their cake and eat it too. I think we want to have our cake and eat it too. We're getting the low gas prices, and we don't have people going all over the state fracking. Back in my home state of Pennsylvania, every available farm and field is being sold off to pump more chemicals into the ground. We don't know all of the consequences, but we do know a kind of a wild west of Pennsylvania gas drilling is not just creating this waste, which may come over our borders, but it's giving us this power. When I've talked with Dan Esty, the outgoing DEP commissioner, when I've talked with the governor about this, they say this is a 10-year window of low-priced natural gas. And to a certain extent, what they're saying is, where it's coming from, that's not really our issue. Isn't it your issue what's happening in Pennsylvania? This low-cost gas is coming to us with a price.
Well, I would – if I were a state legislator in Pennsylvania, if I were a resident of Pennsylvania, I would be outraged that the state has done nothing to protect the safety of its residents, that the regulations there and in many of these states are completely lacking. And the federal government, which should be regulating this, actually passed a law that says no matter what you inject into the ground, what comes out is by law not hazardous waste. They have completely exempted it from federal environmental regulations, and as a result, it's up to the states to take a stand. Now, we can't regulate fracking in Pennsylvania. I don't have that power because I'm a Connecticut legislator. But what I can do is deal with this potential issue of this waste coming over our borders. And what we found when we did a review is that there are no protections, no regulations that protect Connecticut residents and our waters, our streams, and our aquifers from contamination.
But should we be concerned that our comprehensive energy plan put forward by a Democratic governor here basically says Pennsylvania fracking gas is what we're going to rely on to lower the prices for our energy?
Well, I think what we're saying is a little more nuanced than that. What we're saying is we're not pro or anti-fracking. If you want to frack in your state, you should be able to do that.
Frack away.
Frack away. But if you do that, you should be responsible for the entire life cycle. You shouldn't just be able to focus on one piece of it and say, you know what, we're going to take the advantage of the low energy and not have to deal with the contamination with the tough waste that's produced from that. If you want to do it, you should be responsible for the entire life cycle from cradle to grave of the chemicals that go into this stuff and the waste that comes out of it.
There's a lot more we want to get to in just a couple minutes, so I'm just going to quickly rapid fire to Gal Laviel. Look, we asked everyone to bring, you know, maybe some major legislative initiatives. One of the things you sent us was just a long piece that says, look, we need to do a better job getting businesses comfortable here in the state. You were able to spend a little bit of time talking about that already, where when businesses don't know what's happening with the state budget, they can't plan 3 and 5 years out. It's very, very difficult to know the tax regimen and everything else. What do you think the state can and really should do to do more to be, as we call it, business friendly?
Okay, well, I'm ranking member of the Commerce Committee, so I spent a lot of time on this. Businesses tell us constantly, all the time, that they want two things. They want a predictable and attractive tax policy that is really predictable over a period of years, and also a regulatory policy that's easier to deal with. Instead, what we've got are a couple things. Over the past several years, instead of helping businesses across the board, a lot of individual transactions with individual businesses to give them one-shot incentives that do not lower their structural costs. Number two, the Labor Committee is coming out with all these bills, really just a slew of them, that make it very unattractive for businesses to consider coming here, like telling them they have to pay a fee if they don't pay their lowest paid employees enough. And these are companies that already pay more than the minimum wage. Or a state-run retirement plan for that competes with our financial industry. So we should stop doing bills like that, and we should try to find ways to lower taxes for businesses across the board.
Hey, because we've got 1 minute left. This is great. I'm going to give you a dealer's choice. You get to respond to Gal Laviel. This
Can
is like
I do
a
both?
Game show. Or go ahead. Go.
Okay. So the bill that competes with the industry doesn't actually compete with the industry. 60% of the people in the state don't have retirement. And we're not just coming out with things. The other bill that was discussed, did not go through. That's the process of the legislature, and that's the first bill that Gail talked about. School drug zones. I know that's where you were going.
Do it.
School drug zones. The policy is a good policy for the state. It sounds like a bad policy. It's counterintuitive. Basically, it's this. We have 1,500 feet from the school where you have an enhanced penalty for selling drugs or having put drugs or whatever the case may be. The problem is our more densities, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, Waterbury, 1,500 feet means the whole city's encompassed, which means there's no differentiation in penalty. When you have no differentiation in penalty, if I'm going to sell drugs and we know there will be drug dealing, then I have no disincentive to stay away from the children. We need smaller zones. The problem that people bring up is then you can sell drugs to kids outside of that area between 200 and 1,500 feet. There is an enhanced penalty for the selling of drugs to children that's absent the penalty we're talking about. So therefore, the child himself becomes effectively a school drug zone, no problem.
The child is the school drug zone, not the perimeter around the school.
Right.
You were able to do that in about 45 seconds. I'm even able to thank my producers for this. Senator Gary Holder Winfield, great to see you. Thank you for your time.
No problem.
Thanks also to Representative Gail Laviel. Always good to see you. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to Representative Matt Lesser. Thank you so much, Matt.
My pleasure.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, who is on the DL today. Get better, Tucker. Our executive producer is Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.